Greetings and welcome to On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson. It's Wednesday, the 13th of February, 2019. I'm coming at you again here from the beautiful Rainbow Valley community near Takaka on the South Island of New Zealand. That's Te Waipounamu at Te Aroha. It's really nice to be back in my low noise reserve here. You might hear a few chooks in the background and a bit of wind and some locusts, but other than that, it's a beautiful, very tranquil, quiet, and low microwave environment. I'd like to really thank Jewel Stanley at UCY-TV for several years of very amazing dedication to the sharing of valid and accurate and relevant information with her investigative radio network, UCY-TV, and hosting my show, On the Brink. This show, which I believe is On the Brink number 266, because last week I wasn't able to record a new show and Jules rebroadcast my show number 96 that was, again, following from the week before about noise and bioacoustics. It was an earlier show about the relationship between noise, sound, silence, and mental health. This week's show is a very important show that actually combines two or three different very significant and relevant dimensions that are very important to being here now as a human being in the world of today, and that relate directly to a big part of what I do and to this radio show. It's called Honoring Investigative Journalism as an Epistemological Endeavor. So first, I'll sort of define what I mean by those terms. Journalism, in addition to being the writing or keeping of journals, is essentially the process and activity and an industry, if you want to call it, of reporting on events and activities that are happening in the real world. And I'm not a student of journalism per se. You could probably go back and look at the whole history of it, and a lot of it would parallel the development and advent and evolution of our technologies of communication, first printing, and then recording, and then transmission, electronic radio, and then television, and the internet, and all that. So that would be your history of journalism would be a very interesting story in itself, and it makes me think of, some of the earliest journalists I can think of were some of the war photographers from World War II, and then especially the photographers in the Vietnam War who went and showed all the atrocities and everything. I can't really name any names, but I think a big part of photography was originally in the form of, well, they called it photojournalism, telling stories in pictures. And then you had journalism has gone on from there to become an integral part of any kind of media. You've got whole newspapers or magazines that are dedicated to journalism. You might have, The New Yorker, that it might have fiction, might have human interest stories, it might have some investigative journalism talking about environmental issues or political scandals, and just the whole spectrum. And we all know kind of what journalism is, but it's kind of gone beyond what it used to be, as has everything that humans have done. And it's been sort of largely become a form of infotainment, where, just like with a lot of stuff, it gives the impression of telling us about things that matter, but they really don't. And then, so this is a huge area. And then, the paragon of propaganda, Edward Bernays, back from the early decades of the 20th century, his whole idea was not to just sit around waiting for news to happen, which is what, a journalist isn't going to go out and specifically create an event just so that they'd have something to report about. But that's exactly what Edward Bernays advised people to do. Go out and make news, But what he didn't actually say, but what he meant was to create fake events, fake staged operations, fake experts, you know, to give people the impression that something was real and legitimate and verdinkum, when in reality it wasn't. And that was his paradigm all along. So that has kind of been probably the dominant thread through the whole mass communications industry. Now, investigative journalism itself just means reporting on stuff. Going and interviewing people, or, you know, taking photos, maybe with your film crew. But investigative journalism implies that there's a deeper purpose behind it, not to just look at the surface information that's being conveyed or made available, but to probe beneath the surface, to delve into the underlying reality, factors and personalities and motivations behind a lot of the events and activities that we are aware of happening in the world. You might call it sleuthing. That's S-L-E-U-T-H-I-N-G, sleuthing. When I interviewed brilliant musician Ralph Towner back around 1990, he said that that's what I was doing. I was sleuthing, you know, trying to understand exactly what's going on. And when I think of sleuthing, that makes me think of the archetypal detective Sherlock Holmes, who was, you know, kind of, he was always using his ultra intelligence to try to figure out, I mean, I guess, I haven't really read those stories, but I'm guessing he was basically kind of a forensic investigator. He was investigating crimes that had happened that were insoluble. So he was trying to, you know, trace the trail of all the evidence and look at the psychology and motivations, just all this different kind of stuff. Well, that Sherlock Holmes would be a very good archetype or patron saint of investigative journalism, because maybe he wasn't a journalist, but he was an investigator. So he wanted to discover and find the truth and then maybe hand it over to other people who could share it with the world. So really what investigative journalists are all about is sort of like Sherlock Holmes with access to mass media. It also makes me think of investigative journalists. This is kind of part of what, like, secret agents did. You know, James Bond and John Drake of Danger Man and Ilya Kuryakin and Napoleon Solo of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. In a way, even Dr. Richard Kimball, the fugitive, was an investigator in that he was trying to be able to prove the truth of his innocence and find the true culprit in the crime upon which this whole TV show was based. Anyway, and, you know, just as in passing, so I understand that the original James Bond was actually a well-known psychic named John Dee, that's D-double-E, who worked for the Queen of England back in the 15 or 1600s. And because of his psychic powers, he was able to sleuth out, you know, different kind of weird stuff that happens, maybe, you know, murders or, you know, crimes that have been committed and stuff like that. So I'm not positive about that. But anyway, all this stuff, many of these things are whole stories into themselves. But secret agents are often, if you look at the plot of all the James Bond movies, they're trying to figure out who's behind weird sort of military or criminal actions that are happening, whether it's a really rich millionaire or a radical political group or the military themselves. And a big part of investigative journalism that I and the people at UCYTV are involved in, a lot of it has to do with trying to map out or understand or sleuth out what's known as classified information. That's probably the majority of everything that the military does, as well as industry and corporations. It's secret. It's not allowed to be publicly known, mainly because people would freak out if they knew what these people were really doing, how horrific it was, all the experiments, the amount of money is spent on weapon systems and stuff like that. So in general, this is kind of what we do. We're looking at trying to uncover the truth, which is really ultimately no more than a five-letter word in English. But we're trying to penetrate beyond the what's now pretty commonplace as the fictions presented as news, to uncover information that's closer to the reality of what's really going on in the world. That is what investigative journalism is really all about. And you also have to be careful because, as all these secret agents can tell you, knowledge of something creates your involvement in it. So when you come into possession of knowledge about stuff that you're not supposed to know about, you then become a potential threat to the people that wanted it to be secret. You know, so that throws another hole. That's the secret agent dynamic that's thrown into this whole thing. Now, epistemology, that's E-P-I-S-T-E-M-O-L-O-G-Y. You think of epistles as, you know, letters written by the disciples in the Bible or something like that, but epistemology is a branch of philosophy dealing with the origins and nature of what we call knowledge. Now, this is huge. This is such a huge thing. And so now I've just sort of outlined journalism, investigative journalism, and epistemology. We've got a couple of other branches of philosophy. Ontology, which is the study of being or becoming. And metaphysics, which is the study of or trying to comprehend the world that's beyond the purely immediately apprehensible world of day-to-day physical reality. It's very interesting. There's actually a loud plane flying over now. It's one of the very few that I've heard here. It's not that loud. Anyway, but fundamental to epistemology and actually everything we do is not, you know, this is maybe not quite as fundamental as the existence of the earth, the existence of the sun, the existence of life, all the circumstances and ancestors that have come before us that make us possible. Those are the most fundamental prerequisites for us to be here now and to do everything. But at the individual level of human existence, what we call psychology, the understanding of our own internal thought, mental, and cognitive processes, that is fundamental to every single thing that we do. Even if we're unconscious, even if we're sleepwalking, even if we're in total denial or doped up on a bunch of television or anything like that, psychology is the fundamental paradigm that we must use to approach everything that we do, because we're using our psychology all the time. We're using our mind brains all the time, and we can't separate that out from our overall physical organism, even though science does a very good job of doing that. For example, we think, like Western psychology likes to think that the brain and mind receives all its information through the five senses. Well, it's much faster than that, and it doesn't even look at resonance or the fact that your whole body is kind of like an antenna for all kinds of different wavelengths and frequencies of energy, most of which we probably don't even know about or comprehend. And that we're talking about the entire, well, what Western scientists come to call the entire electromagnetic spectrum, but even that is just a map of a portion of reality. But we're constantly living in a sea of every possible wavelength and frequency of electromagnetic radiation that we directly perceive only a very tiny amount of, but yet we're influenced by all of it. So this is the topic of yet another On the Brink radio show that I'm going to work on, and it may be more than one episode. It's called Understanding Radiation, which is very central. But for now, if you sort of map out a basic structure of our individual psychology, which can be symbolized by the capital letter I. I created a piece of art back in 2001. It's called The Ultimate Technology, and I'll put that on my blog posting and email for this. But that really describes what we are and what not just humans, but every life form is an example of the ultimate technology. If you start trying to map out the complexity of every biological and physiological and metabolic and neurochemical process that's happening at every level in every cell of every organism, it's just astronomically complex and amazing that it's all got kind of like, I hesitate to use the word intelligence, but it's got an intelligence of its own. Everything knows exactly what to do. We don't have to tell it. It knows. And if we had to tell every cell in our body, every neuron, how to fire and what information to convey, and every mitochondria, how to make its energy, and every molecule of DNA, and could we do that? Absolutely not. So we only exist. It's like we're the driver of this enormously complex sacred temple vehicle. This is one of the miracles of existing. It's what the ultimate technology, that piece of art was designed. It could have been done a million different ways. It's only the tip of the iceberg, but it's to try to honor. This is the sacred gift of being here now as a human being. But if you look at the primary dimensions of our immediate psychology, you've got your real-time perceptions that are coming in. Like, I'm sitting here, I've got visual input coming in from my eyes via light. I can see these flowers in front of me. I can see my page of notes. I can see a rock. I can see my cameras. I see the leaves on the tree. I see the sun shining down, my cup of coffee, my banana, my feet. And I've got sonic information coming in through my ears, vibrations of sound coming from the cicadas and the sound of the wind rustling in the leaves and the river in the distance and that plane, some chooks. I've got smells coming in, like the beautiful flowers in front of me, the smell of the lavender oil and the essential oils that I've put on me to keep the sandflies away. I've got the sense of touch of my feet on the deck here, and the intensity of the sun shining on my foot, and maybe the feeling of a sandfly biting me now and then. I've got the feeling of my bottom sitting on this cushion. All your different senses and perceptions that we sort of have going on all the time. And so we probably largely don't really pay attention to all this stuff, because we're able to process all this stuff while we're conscious, but we're not really paying attention to it. So you can be looking at something and see it and actually know what it says, for example, without actually consciously being aware of that. So this is one of the things that we really need to watch out for, and that the predatory aspect of those who wish to manipulate us know all too well. So anyway, first you've got our real-time perceptions. That's what's happening right now. And it's very interesting when you think about then the next really, and you cannot underestimate the importance of what we call memory. Memory functions at many, 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 many different levels. You've got cognitional memory, which is the memory of thought, the ability to remember what you just said, what someone told you, what happened this morning, what happened yesterday, where you were last week, where you were a year ago, who your parents are, all this different stuff. This is memory. This is cognitional memory. And it's really quite a mysterious process that's never fully been understood by neuropsychologists. But in addition to cognitive memory, you've got biological memory, which is how your body just might remember things that might have happened to you. When you go to a certain place, if something happened to you, your body remembers or and then related to biological memory is genetic memory, where your body and your genetic energetic structure may remember things that didn't happen to you personally, but that happened to our ancestors. And a really good example of that I feel that this is what was happening was back in May when I was on the Big Island of Hawaii. I was awakened at 3 a.m. by the smell of sulfur dioxide, the smell of the fumes coming off the lava that was erupting about 12 miles from me. And the smell, even though I had never smelled it before in this lifetime, it's like I instantly, oh my God, I'll just never forget how much of a shockwave that smell sent through me. It was as if I knew what it meant from many, 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 many thousands of years ago. My ancestors had smelled that smell and knew that if you smelled that smell at that level of intensity, that it meant that extreme danger in the form of hot molten lava was actually quite close to you and that you really better be aware of what was going on. And so I instantly responded in that kind of way without even thinking about it. I got up and I went outside and I looked up and I saw the stars being obliterated by clouds of smoke. And I go, oh my God. But I then realized that the wind had shifted in the night, and so the smoke was being blown from 12 miles away in a direction it didn't normally go, which is why I smelled it. But to me, that was an example of genetic memory. And then you've got sort of more kind of metaphysical or esoteric things like what the New Age people call the Akashic Records. It's sort of like a collective memory store of everything that humanity's ever experienced, or what Jose Arguelles, the Mayan researcher, called the Noosphere. That's Noosphere, the domain of mind. And to me, if you want to talk about the Noosphere or the Akashic Record, it's just like you can't realistically isolate humanity out from all other life forms. It's a continuum. Just because in our own minds we've set ourselves apart, we think we're the only ones with intelligence, we think that we're on top of the heap, that we're the overlords of the planet, and we've assigned ourselves all these unique special qualities that only we have. That's why we called ourselves Homo sapiens, man the wise. And as you know from other shows and my writings, that this is sort of a constant battle that we fight against this anthropomorphism, anthropocentrism that kind of permeates all of modern human endeavor. So we've got real-time perceptions, we've got memory, and then we've got cognition. So these are really the three, if you take a course in psychology, these are kind of like the three main things that it gets broken down into. Sensation and perception, memory, and cognition. Cognition would be thought. And it's very, very, very complex. This is intimately related to our use of language, the kind of language that we have grown up speaking. And language is sort of like a cognitive paradigm for which your whole foundation of reality is based. And different languages facilitate different kinds of reality. And, you know, for example, all the Western Indo-European languages and cultures are quite similar, very much to the extent that their languages are very similar. There may be different words, different accents, but if they're structured the same way, they encode or encrypt reality in the same kind of way. There's symbolic languages using symbols, words that stand for things, but they're more or less arbitrary, versus what I consider to be harmonic languages that are much more ancient, were originally only spoken. They were never about writing. They were about the sound of the spoken and or sung word or sound, because of the vibration, the resonance that connects you. This is a whole story in itself. The linguist Korzybski had a very, very, very important insight. He said the map is not the territory. And if you think about it, that's one of the dangers of symbolic communication, is that we are in danger of confusing the map with the territory. It would be like if you went into a cafe and saw the menu and saw some food on there, so you ate the menu. That's what we're doing. Humanity is eating the menu of its perceived reality. So, symbolic languages also allow us to transcend the limitations of space and time to a degree. For example, we can tell a story about something that happened long ago and far away, or that people that witnessed it can pass these stories down. And then you've got the Chinese whispers syndrome about how information and stories mutate, but they don't necessarily have to. That's part of what initiatic traditions are about with like indigenous people, is the for you to become initiated, you have to prove that you can memorize and convey the ancient sacred stories in a way that's identical to the way that it was told to you. I think this is very central to the accurate transmission of cultural information. That I think the whales and dolphins do this, as well as the indigenous people of Australia and other places. So you've got, basically, philosophy is a modern endeavor, beginning maybe sort of like with the ancient Greeks, and it's passed on down into the world of today. But ancient people probably didn't have, they probably didn't break it down into different disciplines as a form of study. They kept it simpler and just relied on the most efficient and accurate way to remember and be able to convey essential information and stories. And a lot of times, rather than having a Western scientific view of like the sort of inanimate, depersonalized forces of nature, like light, gravity, electromagnetism, and things like that, electricity, to them, all these were portrayed as being beings, sort of maybe kind of like people. You know, so and I used to think that this was kind of like a limitation in their story, but now I'm really starting to think that this might be a much more valid or useful, harmonious way of understanding that which has come before us, and to know and be aware of important things from the past and things that matter, and how we're actually supposed to live. You know, this it's a true value system. The Hopi Native Americans say that there is a true path of the Great Spirit that humans were always meant to live by. It's a spiritual path based on love and compassion and sharing and the honoring and nurturing of life and our fellow beings, and of not doing destructive things to Mother Earth. And I think it's in its core essence is that of all spiritual paths, regardless of what country it might have come from. So anyway, a really big part of this whole story is, A, how we come to know anything, and what do we actually accept as true, as reality. What do we think matters? What is of value to us? What do we pay attention to? Who do we believe? You've got all kinds of different aspects to this. You've got like the perception of authority. You've got the tradition, that which has come before. You've got the whole notion or science, if you will, of belief. And it's very interesting to contrast belief with knowledge, because ultimately, all knowledge is a form of belief, because you believe it to be true. But knowledge isn't questioned. Knowledge is accepted as the fair dinkum truth, whereas a belief is sort of given that if you believe something, that it's equally accepted that others may not believe it. Or if you're, you know, so it's, I mean, everything I'm talking about is huge. This is a huge, huge dimension of everything we do every day as human beings. So, like for example, religious beliefs, or the paradigm of science, which is kind of like a religion in a way, that people have tended to believe everything that someone claiming to be a scientist says or reports, especially if they've got the white lab coat on. people with lab coats on and that wear suits and ties tend to be accepted as authority figures much more than somebody that looks like me with long hair and a long unidread hanging down to their knee and some hippie wristbands on and sandals, of course. Then you figure in, this is all in a world where we're actually seeking to be honest with each other, which is, I think, how indigenous people have always lived. They didn't have institutions of lying and deception, although they did might have had what you might call black magic that probably has existed in various forms in many, if not most, cultures. The desire of certain people or subgroups to control or manipulate other people through fear, through deception, through what they might really believe was quote unquote magic or, you know, whatever. But there were the black magic part, it's sort of, this is contrasted with the shamanic path of understanding different dimensions and different levels of intelligence, different worlds of beings and consciousness for the purposes of healing and guiding and navigating successfully the reality. So you've got your shamans and healers as opposed to your black magicians. And I guess many cultures have had this kind of thing. So that adds another whole spin on the whole world of mass communication. And I think in the world of today, that's what it's really become. Its primary function is a vehicle for the black magic of the sorcery of propaganda, disinformation, advertisement, perception management, and what the Nazi psychiatrists who were imported from Operation Paperclip that helped to found, for example, the CIA. They called it the Weltanschauungskrieg, the worldview warfare paradigm. So anyway, in addition to what we think of as knowledge and truth and reality, there's also the methods of transfer, the forms that information transfer takes. And so this is where the psychology of mass media comes in, and where I created a concept in 1984 called infotoxin. That's the science of information toxicology. Toxin, T-O-X-I-N, actually comes from the Greek word toxon, T-O-X-O-N, means a bow and arrow, an arrow with a poison tip. That's a toxon. So it means it's a weapon with poison. So that's really, to me, what mass media has really come to be, the largest weapon system in use. Because if the powers that be can control what people think, they don't need to point guns at them. And it's even possible that Hollywood, in its original conception, in its entirety, is really a giant MK Ultra project. That's something to think about. In the same way that I think that especially since President Kennedy, the U.S. presidency has been a psychological operation. So anyway, these are fundamental things to be aware of. And in addition to the dynamics of information transfer and what we hold to be true, we've also need to really pay attention to what we pay attention to, because attention is where your instantaneous point of focus of your what you're processing as your immediate reality. That's in real time. That is probably the central, most important dynamic or aspect of existing that you need to be constantly aware of, is what you're paying attention to at the time. And a big part of all this manipulation using mass media, it's the manipulation of your attention, the capturing or the getting of your attention. Like, for example, over there, that's how stage magicians work. They get your attention over there on something like the girl in the bikini. You're looking at her while right over there in full view, he's actually pulling the rabbit out of his pocket. But you don't see it because you're not paying attention to it. So we've got the ability to actually not see stuff that's in our field of vision, or to not see or hear words or phrases that are actually audible or visible to us. So it's kind of it's a form of deception and self-deception that we all do. in my organization of the infotoxin hypothesis, I've gone into great detail with this with my website called regainyourbrain.org. I've got a document on there called it's about the whole origins of infotoxin and an understanding of the psychology of mass communication. I strongly recommend that you read that, but I call it, whereas Einstein's equation was E equals MC squared, I use the expression MC in parentheses squared. So the square of MC, and MC in this case is not mass and the speed of light, it's mass communication. So mass communication squared is a so kind of like a description or metaphor of the largest dynamic in the whole cultural psychological system that we inhabit. In my fundamental breakdown, I said back when I came up with all this in 2004, we've got first order information, which is primary. This is information that's based on your own experience, your own life. First order information is your immediate experience now or things that you remember. And again, you can't underestimate the importance of memory. First order information is that which you remember, that you were there, you experienced it. You saw that meteor streak across the sky. You smelled the volcanic eruption. You saw the Sasquatch cross the road. You saw the pterodactyl fly across the sky. You saw the guy pull his gun out and shoot that person. You saw that person, steal that money from the bank. You see what I'm saying? So this is first order information. This is stuff that you know was real because you were there. You know, and sure, there's limitations to what you might have thought you saw, you know, and you're also your ability to remember. But first order information has a different order of reality than what I call second order information, which is everything else. Now, think about how fundamental this is. How much in our whole sphere of knowledge and wisdom and reality and information in our whole conceptions of the world, everything that we hold to be true, our models of reality, our everything we've been taught by in schools, everything we've seen on TV, everything, if you didn't experience it yourself, then it's second order information, and that's almost 99.9% of everything that we think we know. The second order information. And so this opens a whole multitude of cans of worms that we actually really need to be aware of if you want to be an effective person walking around in anything even approximating reality rather than a psychological clone that's actually a product of the biggest mind control operations ever conceived, which is called mass communication. So in a way, it's very useful for us to be able to use language and then recorded sound and or video to know about and experience indirectly things that we weren't there for, that were distant from us in space and or time. We can see a film of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. We weren't there, but I'm pretty sure that it really happened. So again, you've got to take all the stuff, every item of secondhand information, you've got to take it with a grain of salt. You've got to question how real it might really be. And then A, how real it might be, and then B, of what value is it of you to know or be aware or attend to or store this in your mind, regardless of whether it's true or not. So this is what we call critical thinking. This is key to existing now. And this is really what investigative journalism is all about, assisting people with the process of critical thinking, because it's trying to provide accurate and valid information that is not going to be provided by mainstream media, because mainstream media, by and large, it's not there to inform you. It's there to give the impression that you're being informed, but it's using every trick in the book, all the most advanced psychology and psychological warfare and military engineering and tactics and research for many, 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 many decades. All this goes into every time you turn on the radio or TV, you're being bombarded by the highest, most sophisticated level of psychological warfare techniques and technology that's ever existed. But you think it's the news and entertainment, like, you know, just some movies or some adverts or some, the most dangerous might be documentaries that are purported to be the truth or reality. And not that some of the stuff that you can see isn't good. You know, but it's really hard to tell. So, and everybody's different. Everybody does not want to eat the same diet. Everybody does not want to assimilate the same artifacts of mass media. But you don't want to eat at the same people that eat at McDonald's might want to watch the Springer show or also follow the antics of the Trump administration, if you see what I mean. It's not exactly a healthful diet for mind or body. So there's people, if you want to listen to UCY TV radio or watch a John Pilger documentary or a movie by Ron Fricke, who made Koyaanisqatsi and Baraka, or a documentary about Rachel Carson, this is in the equivalent of ingesting into your mind, the equivalent of going to a really nice organic garden and picking some certified organic vegetables and eating them raw, or making some beautiful juice like I just did a couple of weeks ago, eating beautiful, healthful, harmoniously grown gifts from the plant kingdom. This is like, and there's a very powerful comparison between what you ingest into your mind and what you ingest into your body, because infotoxin is the poisoning of your mind, and toxicology is traditionally the study of the poisoning of our bodies and our environment. So they're, it's all happening, and it's really a lot of the same processes. A lot of the same corporate bureaucratic entities are behind all the forms of toxicosis that we're experiencing in the world. So anyway, investigative journalism is really about trying to discern truth or reality from lies or fiction. And it can be quite tricky because some of the main enemies or obstacles of investigative journalism are, for example, the fact that so much of everything that the military does and corporations, it's classified. It's classified for, they'll say it's for our protection, but why is it that we don't need to know? Because is it not just about how much it's cost or the devious things that they're doing to subvert the governments of other countries, to kill people they don't like, to wage war against Mother Earth in every possible way, to conduct geophysical warfare using ionospheric heaters that can manipulate and create disrupted weather patterns, generate artificial earthquakes, all this different kind of stuff. Covert operations to, for example, the Bay of Pigs operation to land soldiers in Cuba and blame it on Russia or something like that, you know. This is all like par for the course. We've got, you hear the expression conspiracy theory a lot. Well, really, conspiracy just means, conspirare in Latin, it means to breathe together. So we're all co-conspirators in the web of life, but conspiracy, small groups of people making decisions in secret behind closed doors, that's how every business on the planet works. That's par for the course. People sit there and discuss what they're going to do, you know, how they're going to wage this marketing campaign and how they're going to steal all the resources from these indigenous people and forcibly relocate them, and they're going to chop down all these forests and do all this deep seabed mining and convince the people of the Cook Islands that deep seabed mining is good for them and all this stuff. So conspiracy is a dime a dozen. That's how a business works. And they keep it all secret because the people would be outraged. The people, if they actually knew all the stuff that was going on, like what really happened with 9/11, what really happened with JFK, what's really going on with the whales and dolphins and everything, they would be so pissed off that if enough people mobilized, they could take out all the evil bankers and rulers and stuff. But no, they're using every trick in the book, mass communication being on top of the heap, to keep people stultified, dumbed down, anesthetized, distracted, entertained, to keep them sitting on their sofa there eating their fast food. Another thing is the basic scientific ignorance of people, just the lack of education to even understand the difference between, for example, ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, the difference between the breeding of animals versus genetic modification, recombinant genetic engineering. Carl Sagan commented on this about how in the world of today we're all intimately surrounded by and involved with all kinds of advanced technology, but almost no one has the faintest idea of what any of it is or how it works, much less the immediate or long-term dangers of these technologies, like microwaves, for example, like fluoride, like the 1080, like GMOs, like the whole global nuclear scenario. Yet another obstacle for investigative journalism and the quest for truth and reality is the psychological process that we call denial. We're brilliant. Humans excel at being in denial of stuff that they don't want to know about, that they want to forget, stuff they did, stuff that they don't want to accept as true, but it may well be. And then you can go to the level of collective denial or the suppression or repression of memories of really bad things that have happened. This can happen at the individual level, but psychoanalyst Emanuel Bielakovsky from Russia wrote extensively about how he thought that humanity was actually collectively traumatized by all the planetary level cataclysms that we've experienced throughout our existence, where we've been reduced down to just probably handfuls of people many times, not knowing how we were going to survive, how we were going to make it through 100 years of living under a smoke-filled atmosphere with no sun, in caves with no food. I mean, so, and he said that we, these memories of what we lived through are so traumatic that because we refuse to accept and embrace them and to work through it, we continually repress it. And so it's come out in the form of that we're reenacting our own destruction. We're doing our best to emulate the gods. The gods being the forces of cosmic destruction, the cataclysmic upheavals accompanying perhaps cometary or asteroid impacts, planetary-wide tectonic upheaval, tidal waves, tsunamis, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes. Who knows? We've lived through all this, and the whales and dolphins have lived through it too. But they remember. They remember. They haven't forgotten. And they're trying to tell us that not only have we lived through this, that something like this is going to be coming again soon, which is the fulfillment of the Hopi prophecy of the Day of Purification. That's another whole story in itself. Another obstacle or enemy of investigative journalism is the pervasiveness and ubiquity of mass communication, because people turn on the news, but they just don't even question that that's the truth. And then a lot of people just don't let it into their mind, but most people who do accept that it's true. And there's, you know, you can read books on psychological warfare. There's one called Truth is Our Weapon. And I saw another one, a quote from a guy writing a psychological warfare textbook from Johns Hopkins University, saying that one of their psychological warfare strategies was to present the public via radio or TV with totally accurate, valid, relevant information in many different ways for many years, just so that people would be conditioned to feeding at this trough, just so that on the very day when they needed them to swallow a totally fake story, like for example 9/11, that they would, without even questioning it. You know, I can show you the quote from that in a psychological warfare textbook. It's what the Nazi psychiatrist called the Weltanschauungskrieg, worldview warfare. That's the paradigm of mass communication. Another factor, obstacle to investigative journalism, is the sheer quantity of these artifacts of mass communication, the overload of gratuitous pseudo-information that sort of saturates the whole reality of especially You know, maybe not people living in rural wilderness areas or in areas like Topeka, but people in cities tend to be highly involved with mass media, television and radio. They want it on all the time. Yet another obstacle is the whole paradigm of fake science that's really become dominant in the past few years, especially in the wake of the whole climate change thing. But the editor of the Journal of the American Medical Association 2 years ago wrote an article in which he stated that he felt that at least 50% of every scientific article published in every journal now was fake or fraudulent. That's another whole world of exploration in itself. Zbigniew Brzezinski, very, very, very top advisor to every administration since the Carters, said point blank that the elite that wish to control humanity won't stop at anything. They'll use the most advanced, sophisticated psychological and neurophysiological methods and technology in order to control and manipulate the population, which includes microwaves being beamed down from satellites to debilitate the thought process of whole populations of people. So I'd really like to thank Jewel Stanley at UCY-TV for making her beautiful, awesome investigative journalism platform to exist, to try to spread truth and reality in as many different ways as we can, for hosting my own work. And I'll just mention a few of my favorite investigative journalists from the past. There used to be a show on CBS called 60 Minutes that was investigative journalism. It was hosted by Dan Rather. And they would go and just go and check out all kinds of stuff. So that's really cool. And then there was Barbara Walters. I think she was also on CBS. But the sort of Mac Daddy of investigative journalism was this guy named Walter Cronkite. That's C-R-O-N-K-I-T-E. He got into all kinds of stuff. And then in the world of today, one of my favorite investigative journalists is a guy named John Pilger, P-I-L-G-E-R. He's Australian, but he expatriated to England, and basically in protest of Australia's treatment of their indigenous people. He reports a lot on world events and politics, and I'm not so much on the same page as he is with a lot of stuff, but I am on the same page with him in terms of his work on behalf of the indigenous people of Australia, who are my very favorite heroes of the human population. And I'll close the show in honoring Rachel Carson, my very, very favorite person that's ever existed, because not only was she a very leading edge, true scientist and scientific researcher, a naturalist, a marine biologist, she had a very broad spectrum view of what was really happening in the world, and with her work, Silent Spring, brought to light the whole chemical toxicity paradigm. But also was her love of nature and the natural world, her brilliant insights into our unity with Mother Earth and all our fellow life forms. But not only was she a leading edge scientist and naturalist, she was equally an extraordinarily talented writer and journalist. So she fulfilled both criteria of doing very leading edge independent scientific research that mattered, and the extraordinary ability to express it, convey it, and share it, and get it out there to the public. So one without the other is not nearly as powerful as both together, because if you're able to have the research but you can't get it out there, who's going to know? Or if you're able to share something with the world but you have nothing to say, then you're just going to be like all the other media mouth talking heads out there. So anyway, live simply so that others may simply live. And watch out for infotoxin. Check out my site, regainyourbrain.org. And I'd really like to thank again Jewel Stanley at UCY-TV for making this awesome investigative journalism platform possible and for hosting On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off from the Rainbow Valley community. To Waipanamu, Aotearoa, Mother Earth, Milky Way Galaxy, the universe.
Good day.
Expense it takes to speak to you this way, my friends, recorded songs to make. I see it only as a way to communicate, to share some thoughts, a little critical chest on problems everywhere. It's infotoxin.
Bloody all our sense.